Good morning and welcome to Behind the Headlines, your Friday morning Utah news wrap-up from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW and heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the program, after five deaths among unsheltered residents, Salt Lake City's mayor signs an emergency order to expand shelter space in Utah's capital. A retired federal scientist highlights a previously unconsidered threat from a proposed canal extension project to the Great Salt Lake's ecosystem. And a columnist wonders why Utah taxpayers are on the hook for millions of dollars to private law firms to defend controversial laws. Joining me for this conversation here in studio, we've got Salt Lake Tribune city and county reporter Blake Apgar. And welcome back, Blake. Good morning. Thanks for being here.
Hey, good morning, Roger.
It's a pleasure to have you. You are my only guest at the moment. We are awaiting others, and we will see if and when they show up. But thanks for doing this. And listeners, you can join this conversation a little bit later in the show. We'll hear from Leah Larson, who is going to talk about the Great Salt Lake, and Robert Gerke, who is a news columnist with the Tribune. You can join this conversation with your questions and comments by calling us up at you can't call us today. You can tweet to us. The number to tweet to. Wow. The address to tweet to is at KCPW, and we would love to answer your questions and comments there. Joining us in studio right now, by the way, is Robert Gerke, who is news columnist with the Tribune. Hey, Robert.
Good morning.
Glad you're with us. It's bitingly cold weather out there, and the overnight low temperatures especially have been very low. And Blake Apgar, in recent days, five unsheltered people, folks who have been living on the street, have died, and the cold, officials think, played a role in their deaths. But it turns out also that the shelters that are there to help people who are suffering from homelessness, experiencing homelessness, they are at or near capacity. And so various officials, Salt Lake City's mayor included, are taking some action. What is the action that they are taking, Blake?
Yeah. So on Tuesday, Mayor Aaron Mendenhall signed an emergency order that would expand the capacity of shelters that serve the overflow winter population that needs to be served. I do think it's important that we're clear that while there have been five people on the streets who have died since Monday the 12th. We don't know exactly the cause. The medical examiner is going to take a little bit of time to figure that out. But I do think, officials have said it's reasonable to assume that exposure to these winter conditions played a role or was a factor.
Contributing factor. Yeah. The onset of the cold happens, demand goes up. I think we predict it every year that demand, people will be seeking shelter to get out of the cold. How does this order from Salt Lake City's mayor, and there are others in Mill Creek and other parts of the Salt Lake Valley that are doing this as well. How do they work inside the shelters? What do they actually do?
So this is going to affect four shelters. It's going to affect the three homeless resource centers. So there's two in Salt Lake City, there's one in South Salt Lake, and then there's an overflow shelter in Mill Creek. It's going to affect those. The resource centers already have a set capacity. And what happened was back in September, the state, in planning for winter, decided to up the capacity of that. So they had the legal authority. They call it like flex capacity. And so that was already in place, those extra winter beds. And up till about a week ago, people were feeling like state officials were feeling pretty confident that they had the space available to serve those who wanted to be indoors. With this cold snap that we've seen, that there was just a crush of demand. And what Salt Lake City's order does is it takes that expanded capacity and expands it even further. And so it's going to create 95 additional beds over coming weeks.
And just a question that occurs to me as you say that, is that you have these shelters, these resource centers of a certain, physical size. Do they have space for the beds that they're adding? Do they have staffing for the beds that they're adding?
Space is a question that I would assume so, because I think this is working within fire code. And so I think, you know, they can legally have that many people in there safely. Staffing is a different issue, and that has been a persistent issue in the lead up to the winter. Service providers are just having a hard time finding people to staff these positions. And that's going to cause some delays in getting these extra beds available. Wayne Niederhauser, who runs, who's the state homeless coordinator, he said that, you know, it could be weeks before these are available, and it's all due to staffing. Like, the funding is in place. It's just hard to find the people to oversee those beds.
And Niederhauser, he was somebody who, I mean, he's the one who was caught off guard by this to a certain extent. He said a couple of weeks back, as you pointed out, I think you've reported on before, that things were looking good, but then this cold snap happened, and it turns out they weren't, I guess, prepared for this. What other sort of measures? I mean, I think there's a lot of people who we know do seek shelter. We also know that there are a lot of people who, it doesn't matter how cold it is, they don't want to go to the shelters. And how, you know, are the city and state dealing with those populations of people who are reticent and who are still going to suffer adverse effects from cold temperatures?
Yeah. I do want to pause quickly just to note that that a lot of the confidence I was projecting on the state level was due to the fact that the overflow shelter was open earlier this year than it's ever been before. There have been more beds available in the winter, you know, to this point than there ever has been before. And that's why there was so much confidence in the system. As for getting in touch with, you know, populations that are resistant to seeking shelter. I mean, there are a lot of reasons that folks who live on the streets don't want to go into shelter. I mean, it's that is a persistent problem because, you know, it can be a difficult environment for someone who has, say, PTSD, or for someone who may have in the past in a congregate shelter setting had some of their belongings taken. And so those are really, really difficult things. There are, you know, the Volunteers of America, they do outreach, and so they are checking in on folks daily. They're pulling employees from across their organization to help with that. It's kind of an all hands on deck effort to keep people safe. And if someone who's sleeping in a tent doesn't want to go to a shelter or refuses to go to a shelter, VOA is trying to help them get the supplies that they need to stay safe at night.
Mm-hmm. Something you said before you answered that part of my question stuck out, which is that more beds were available than ever before, yet we're still seeing, reaching capacity. Does that mean that we're seeing higher numbers of people experiencing homelessness than we have in recent years? Do we know that yet? I know that there's a point in time count coming up in January where providers or organizations go out and try and get an accurate sense of, or as best they can, an accurate sense of how many people are suffering from homelessness. Do we have a sense of that, Blake?
Yeah. So we're going to have more updated numbers soon, and I can't tell you a precise number right now, but in the conversations that I've had, this is something, a population that continues to grow here. To what extent and how it compares to the past, I'm sorry, I just don't have the specifics, but I know it continues, especially as the population grows here, you know, the number of people experiencing homelessness will grow too.
Okay. I know Wayne Niederhauser talked about, you know, sort of increasing the number of shuttle trips between, you know, the shelter and, you know, to and from the shelters to try and get people to give them a sort of quicker access to the shelter. Is that the idea behind that?
Yeah, this is a tricky part. The transportation part, especially out to Mill Creek, is tough because while the resource centers are, and when I say resource centers, I'm talking about the shelters in Salt Lake City and South Salt Lake. When those are pretty much at capacity, Mill Creek is about at 80% capacity, or it was as of last weekend. And so the problem you have to solve for is filling those 20 beds. And so they were running buses, I think, twice a day. I guess with the frequency of the shuttles, by moving to shuttles and doubling the frequency, the hope is that you can capture more people to take over there and fill those beds. There's just it's a logistical challenge.
I want to talk about some of the outside-the-box solutions to the housing and homelessness crisis. But before we go there, Blake, I think maybe I'll bring in the columnist, Robert Gierke. And Robert, this is I feel like this is a perennial problem. Obviously it is, and an issue that basically, I mean, it's a stain on our ability to deal with having a society that helps people in a way that is is worthwhile. And I'm not blaming anybody. I just think that this is where we are.
I think that, that's been my frustration with this, because every year everybody kind of is shocked that winter comes, and that and every year it feels like we're scrambling and kind of unprepared for it. And, you know, as Blake mentioned, it's staffing this year. Staffing is hard all over. It's a challenge. And so maybe they get some slack on that, some leeway, but every year, you know, we're kind of scrambling to try to find roofs to put over people's heads when winter comes. And, you know, and they have some tools at their disposal. We talked last week, I think, about how the hotel voucher system that they have, particularly for families that kind of need to stay together. And so there are some options there at their disposal. And ultimately, at the end of the day, I think if people want services, you know, if they need a place, they'll find a place. You know, they're not going to get turned away because of capacity issues. But at the same time, you know, we need to make sure that these services are easily available. Not just that if you go through certain hoops, you can get them. And we need sort of a continuum of these resources from warming centers all the way up to, you know, to hotel rooms for families that need to stay together. So it's always a challenge every winter, and you know, every winter it seems to have these hiccups, I guess, in the system where we're just not ready for it when it comes.
I know also that it's not a static population, meaning the homelessness is, I think, for most people who experience homelessness, it is a temporary situation. There is chronic homelessness where you have people who are perennially who remain on unsheltered for a long time. But Blake, I guess it's hard to maybe prepare when you don't have the accurate numbers, but it always seems like there's more than people are expecting.
If I could, the problem kind of ends up being you have you have a certain population, and then when we get these cold snaps, it spikes. And so you can't really staff and have beds to accommodate the spike. You kind of have to have flex capacity, as you put it, which reminded me of Back to the Future, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah.
But it is. You get these peaks and valleys in the demand on your resources. I also just want to add, this is not just a Salt Lake problem.
No.
Because obviously Ogden, Southern Utah, they are also dealing with it. And so, you know, it's a challenge all over the state.
Robert, before I go back to Blake, do you think, I mean, I think about when the Road Home closed, the major homeless shelter that was downtown, and, you know, there was much discussed gap in bed numbers.
Went from 1,100 beds to 750 beds.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm wondering if in the intervening years, if you think that things have improved, have they gotten worse? Like, I look at it and I can't quite tell.
It is hard to tell. I think that there was some merit to some of the strategies they were trying to deploy. I think there's this notion that you can operate on, serve more people because it's an increasing population, as we've discussed, with fewer resources and fewer beds, it didn't make sense from the start. And so, again, it's about trying to accommodate those surges, those peaks when you get them. And now we find the challenges of that, you know, a challenge of meeting that demand.
It's not necessarily peaks in homelessness. It's peaks in people seeking services, predictable in the winter because it's cold and they want to get out of it.
Yeah, and the legislature tried to address that this year, but with new legislation that basically compelled local leaders to come together and develop a plan. They wanted 400 beds for this winter. I think the number that we ended up at was in the 340, 350 range. You know, the only shelter that local officials were able to come up with was the Mill Creek Shelter, and that was 100 beds. So that's why they had to increase the capacity of the resource centers to help get closer to that 400 number. To Robert's point about the total number of beds, with this 95 beds, we get the system up to about that 1,100 number.
Well, Peyton Harkins had a story about the 159 Utahns known to have died experiencing homelessness last year. She attended the annual Vigil of Deaths that occurs each winter. I've been to that vigil. It's a very moving event and a tough one to go to. Blake, I know the Tribune has covered other aspects of homelessness, and we don't have to spend a great deal of time here, but the idea of legal encampments for people who are unsheltered, it was an idea that I think was being floated by some Salt Lake City Council members. Has that idea advanced much here in the state of Utah? And then, you know, as I think about the cold temperatures, is that something that that these camps can help deal with? I guess are the legal camps going to prevent people from getting frostbite or from dying from the cold, if they exist? And where are we in the problem? These are so many questions together. But let's start with the first one, which is, has that idea advanced in the Salt Lake Valley?
You know, the idea of a legal camp is. I think that's still tricky. But where we have seen progress is, you know, Wayne Niederhauser has been open to the idea of a different kind of non-congregate shelter. So when we talk about congregate shelters, we're talking about homeless shelters, the way you would traditionally imagine them, with a bunch of people in a room. Non-congregate shelter that aims to serve the population we talked about earlier of folks who are resistant to going to a shelter. So it's removing some of the barriers to get people inside a shelter. And so it's tough. I don't know how effective a tent would be in the winter. I talked to one advocate this week who just said, these are not the nights that we want people out in the cold, and it doesn't matter how good your tent is. We just don't want people in the cold. But I do think there is some movement toward a non-congregate setting.
Huh. One of the reasons I asked that question was because of some coverage that the Tribune did on a legal encampment in Denver, which also has cold weather, and there were photographs that your colleague Trent Nelson took of those structures, and they seem sort of more substantial than your common tent. I don't know. Are we headed that direction? I know that we have the tiny homes village coming eventually. But yeah, I don't know.
If I could jump in, the places that have had success with the encampments, you mentioned Denver, but I think most of the places that have had success with them are warmer climates. But if you have designated camping areas, right, you're not going to have this constant fear of the police coming in and, you know, taking apart your camp, and so you do end up with more substantive structures that maybe are a little bit better equipped to survive the elements. I think this issue is going to be sort of front and center in the upcoming mayoral race, because we've seen Rocky Anderson, who's running against Mayor Aaron Mendenhall, already kind of embracing this idea and sort of assailing the mayor's record on dealing with homeless issues. And so I think this entire issue that we're talking about right now is one that's going to get a lot of attention in the coming months.
Okay, when is isn't that election?
It's next year.
It's next year. Okay. All right. Well, an early start to the campaign, and I know that it's been right. That was the sort of focus of the launch of Rocky, former Mayor Rocky's campaign. We can talk about that later.
We'll have
talk about the politics later. And but okay. So well, Blake, I'm going to thank you for this. I don't know how much more there is to say on this topic other than the fact that, you know, we are hopeful that there is space enough for people out there who are suffering in the cold weather. Blake Apgar covers the Salt Lake City and County for the Salt Lake Tribune, and thanks for covering this for us today, Blake.
Thanks.
Yeah. We're going to take a quick break, and then we come back. When we come back, we will turn to the columnist and some of his takes on some machinations of state government. Stay with us. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined by Tribune reporter Blake Apgar and by news columnist Robert Gerke. This is our live Friday morning Utah news wrap-up, and you can join us with your questions and comments by tweeting them to @KCPW. Well, we will turn to Robert Gerke. Gerke Wenceslas, as you are on Twitter. Holiday-inspired name for our, that the columnist gave himself on Twitter. Robert, you are a columnist. You dig into the news, and then you get to opine on it as well, which means that you do a job that is different than Blake, who is laying out the facts for us. I want to explore a couple of your columns now, both having to do with state government, as I said before the break. And maybe to start with the piece that you wrote about how much money Utah taxpayers are on the line for legal expenses that are getting paid to private firms. This has to do with various lawsuits that I think you view these lawsuits or the laws that they are defending more as political stunts rather than laws in the public interest. Who are we paying as taxpayers to do this legal work, and what are we paying for?
So it's not all that unusual when a government entity, whether it's the state, county, city, gets sued over something they do, a law they pass or something, some policy they enact. It's not that unusual for them to go out and hire outside firms to help represent them. Usually they try to handle it in-house, but sometimes they don't have the resources. They need to bring in more people. So that's not that out of the ordinary. What I think is a little surprising to me is that just in the past year, the state has hired in four different lawsuits, the state has hired outside counsel. This is the Bears Ears National Monument litigation, right. The abortion litigation, the redistricting litigation, and the last one is the transgender lawsuit. In all four of those, they've gone out and hired outside counsel. In three of the cases, they've hired the same firm. It's this firm called Consovoy McCarthy, and the Utah office of Consovoy is led by this attorney named Tyler Green, who up until just recently was working at the Attorney General's office, basically doing this job of defending these laws. And in at least two of these instances, the contracts that were awarded were no bid contracts. They were emergency contracts. Where the money just starts flowing and they start working and there's no other competition for it, and some of these lawyers are getting between $600 and $700 an hour to represent the state on this, and it just raises questions in my mind for two questions really. One is when the legislature is told in advance that these bills might be unconstitutional and they will be sued, and the legislature goes ahead and passes them anyway. Taxpayers, I think, need a certain amount of transparency into the process, and they need to know how much that of their money is going to defend these laws that they were warned were probably unconstitutional or might be unconstitutional in the first place. And then the second thing is sort of the chumminess of the whole system, right? You've got these three cases that where Tyler Green's firm is representing the state, is defending the state, two on behalf of the Attorney General's office, the most recent one he's representing the legislature. And then, again, a guy who formerly worked at the Attorney General's office until just recently. And then in the fourth one, you've got Tom Lee, former Justice Tom Lee, the brother of Mike Lee, who is just stepped down from the bench, and his partner, John Nielsen, who recently left the Attorney General's office as well, getting all of this money. And how much money is it going to be? It's kind of hard to say right now. In just between March and September of this year, Consovoy received about $450,000. But that's before they even signed the contract with the legislature.
Right. Wasn't there sort of a going back and saying this applies to like a retroactive application of we're going to pay you for work because you exist? I don't know.
There was some retroactive. He had it was in the abortion case, and that one came up fast, and so he was working on it before the contract was in place. Also, in the case of the Tom Lee one, once he started working for the state, his firm started working for the state on the transgender lawsuit, and then it was backdated to July 1st. So that may be the one you were talking about as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, I think I was. Yeah.
Lee's firm has received about $250,000. The legislature's put aside $5 million for the Bears Ears litigation, the monument litigation. So you can kind of get a sense of the kind of dollar figures that we should anticipate in the coming year.
Sure.
As these cases make their way through. It's going to be millions of dollars that's going to cost taxpayers to defend these laws that, again, just regardless of your opinion of the laws, you know, they were told that there would be litigation over these.
On that point, the fact that they were told that there would be litigation, well, maybe this is less about the fact that they were told there would be litigation, because you can predict that certain groups are going to sue over certain laws being passed, whether or not they are or are not unconstitutional. But in those instances where a law is said, you know, they're told in advance, this is going to be this has a conflict with the Constitution, so you can expect a lawsuit based on a constitutional challenge. I remember thinking at one point, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but that those constitutional notes the legislature was getting rid of.
Those used to be attached to the bills. So the way it would work is the legislature would say, "I want to outlaw dogs," whatever, and the attorneys would come back and say, they'd write the bill, you know, because that's what they're the attorneys, that's what they do, and then at the bottom they say it would be unconstitutional because of these cases, or the high likelihood this would be deemed unconstitutional. Now, I will say in defense of the legislature, when they passed the abortion law, it was clearly unconstitutional. There was no way it would have flown. But since the Dobbs decision, the constitutionality of that sort of thing has changed. Mm-hmm. So the legal footing of that has changed a little bit. But
hence the trigger and trigger law.
But if they're going to keep passing these bills, though, they need to fund the Attorney General's office at an adequate level, so they don't have to keep going out every time and getting outside counsel and leaning so heavily on these people. And be able to keep people like Tyler Green, who left the Attorney General's office and went out on his own and is now making way more money than he was before, doing basically the same job he was doing before. Just to put it into perspective, he was making about 140 plus a year, 140,000 plus a year, which if you break it down, as I did, it comes to about $60 to $70 an hour. Now he's making $700 an hour to do basically the same work for the state. So that's where I think we've fallen down. You've got to provide enough money to the Attorney General's office that they can staff up, keep these attorneys on staff, and then they have to rely less on going out and on the private market and paying a lot more for the same work, a lot more taxpayer money.
I mean, the AG's office does a lot of stuff. There's a lot of work that they do. Do they save? Is there the possibility, Robert, maybe that they save this kind of, I mean, to your mind, political work that is, you know, dirty for outside counsel, for outside attorneys, because it in some ways is sort of removing it from the work of government, which maybe is more public?
No. I don't think that's the case, because the job of the Attorney General is to defend the laws of the state of Utah. And so, you know, it is political in some ways. I mean, Attorney General Sean Reyes is not an apolitical person, so I think that's not really a concern in that regard. And I just think that, you know, I, and to be fair, and again, giving them, I guess, the benefit of the doubt here, or giving them some credit here, they're also being sued by very high-priced, powerful, capable litigators. And so, you know, you don't go into battle with you know, a ragtag army if you're facing you know, very reputable, formidable opponents. So there is some value, like I said at the outset, there is some value in going out and getting these private firms, but I think they've leaned too heavily on it to defend laws that are basically political posturing by the legislature.
I would like to know, I don't know if this is addressed in your column, but how Utah compares to other states when it comes to retaining private firms versus using public attorney generals, that apparatus.
I'm afraid I don't have an answer for that one.
All right. Well, I said that there were two columns that you had about the machinations of government. Maybe we can just do a quick update on the next one, which is follow-up to something we talked about last week, those World Cup trips taken by the Senate President, Stuart Adams, and by Sean Reyes, who we were just talking about, paid for by the government of Qatar. There was a law, and we discussed this briefly last week, that would have not prevented these trips from happening, but would have required them to be disclosed. Or there was a proposed law, didn't come together, or that part of that stipulation in the law was gutted. What happened there?
Yeah, so Representative Candace Perucci had sponsored a bill that would have required foreign governments that hire lobbyists in the state to have them register as lobbyists, which seems like a no-brainer, but and also would have required elected officials when they travel on the dime of a foreign government to disclose that annually. I don't think annually is adequate, but that's neither here nor there. That was what the bill would have done. It had 61 co-sponsors in the House, flew through, unanimously in the House, and then stalled out in the Senate until the last night of the session. And Senator Kurt Bramble of Provo proposed a substitute that stripped out the disclosure piece. So you end up with this situation where Attorney General Reyes is taking trips to Qatar for the World Cup, paid for by the government of Qatar. You've got Stuart Adams, who's going with his grandkids to Qatar. Tenuous at best, I think, official, capacity for these. I don't know that Utahns writ large benefit from them taking these trips. It seems like a junket that they're getting.
Right. Because they're elected.
Because of the office they hold.
Yeah.
At the bare minimum, in my mind, there should be disclosure of these. We wouldn't have known that they would have gone to the World Cup. In fact, I've learned that they were not too happy that I found out that they went to the World Cup on Qatar's dime. And so we wouldn't have known about this because there is no disclosure right now. So that's all this bill would have done.
I'm going to say wouldn't have without your efforts to file public records request and get to the bottom of it.
Yeah.
So thanks.
Yeah. And Senator Bramble was concerned that if an elected official takes a trip paid for by a foundation and that foundation is partially or substantially funded by a foreign government, the elected official may not even know the original financing and that would maybe trip them up. So that's why he wanted to take that out.
Can that just be clarified in a sort of, make the law a little bit more?
There's a rule up at the legislature that no bill gets more scrutiny than a bill that impacts them. And so they go through every what if, machination that they can. I don't think it's that complicated. I think if it's a foreign funded, there's the Qatar Foundation was one of these groups that when Stuart Adams went out on the trade mission with Spencer Cox back in September, that was one of the organizations that he met with. Well, it's clearly funded by the government. Says as much, there's documentation. So I don't think it's all that difficult. I think, but at the end of the day, and here's the larger point, I guess, is these guys are supposed to be working for us. So a little transparency on who's paying for them to fly around the world and go to sporting events. I mean, the airfare wasn't cheap. The tickets were, I am told, several thousand dollars each because they were in a lounge. And so, it's not a cheap trip. And again, what benefit did taxpayers gain? Almost nothing. The other point you made, or the other thing you brought up, was the open records request. One of the frustrations I'm having with the Attorney General's office, frankly, is I filed an open records request. The justification for him taking this trip initially was that he had done all this consulting, given advice to the government of Qatar about human trafficking, had meetings in California and on Zoom and so forth. And so I filed a grandma request for anything mentioning any of these meetings, and there wasn't anything. And so, it kind of calls into question. They said it was organized through the Attorney General Alliance, which is used to be the Council. Coalition of Western Attorney Generals. It used to be that. And so they said it was organized through that. But that's still a quasi-official business if he's traveling and taking these trips and doing this consulting in his capacity as Attorney General for the state of Utah. And the fact that there's nothing there indicates either it didn't exist in the first place or he's doing semi or quasi-official business on a separate account of some sort that he's not going to disclose to the public, which I think is really problematic because we saw that with the past attorneys general trying to conceal some of their activities.
Okay. Robert, I'm sorry to cut you short on this, but it's fascinating coverage and just And is there, you said, well, like, one final point. Is there not a sort of reconfigured bill that will be run this year that will try and address this problem as well?
Representative Perucci says she's going to continue to work on it. She wasn't too happy with the effectiveness of the compromise, and it may be back in a different form this year.
Okay. We're going to take one more quick break in the show. That's Robert Gerke, who is news columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune. We've also got Blake Apgar, city and county reporter with the Tribune, here in studio with us. When we come back, we will turn to our underplayed story of the week to save time for a recorded segment with Leah Larson, Salt Lake Tribune water and land use reporter. Stay with us.
For all of those moments when public radio surprised and inspired you, added to your understanding of the world, or connected you to your community, please take a minute to give back. The important public service KCPW provides would not be possible without listeners who take the extra step to keep it going. Make your year-end tax-deductible contribution today. Give online at kcpw.org, and thank you.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I am joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Robert Gerke and Blake Apgar. This is our Friday morning local news roundup, and to save time for a recorded conversation about the Great Salt Lake, we are going to turn right now to our final segment of the show, the underplayed stories of the week. I guess it's not really the final segment this time around, but generally is. Blake Apgar, I'll give you the first choice. What's your pick for underplayed story?
So I had a story out a couple days ago about an analysis of beer prices at airports across the country.
I read this. I saw it.
And Salt Lake City was on the lower end of that list. It was the second lowest average beer price. And that's thanks to a policy that I think most people don't know about at the airport. That is, and it's my favorite thing about the Salt Lake City airport, vendors there are not allowed to charge more at the airport than they do on the streets.
Wow.
I
don't mean to cut you off. I check out Blake's article at sltrip.com. We're running low on time, so I'm going to save it there. But that's an amazing fact that I didn't know until right now. Yeah. Robert Gerke, your pick for underplayed story.
Brian Maffley had a story about oil and gas wells that have been abandoned, hundreds of them on state and federal land. Regulators are trying to, sometimes these fly-by-night oil producers, they just disappear. And these are venting a lot of methane into the air. So I think it's a problem that been a problem for a long time that they've been trying to get their hands around at sltrib.com.
Yeah, and a really interesting story about him holding his hand over a leaky well and feeling the methane coming out. I'm going to go with the fact that wolves are being released in Colorado. Gray wolf packs are soon going to be roaming the western Colorado, and they will almost certainly come into Utah. Utah officials are not very happy about that. Mm-hmm. But another Brian Maffley pick. You can check it out at sltrib.com. We also pay lobbyists something like $500,000 a year to get wolves off the endangered species list. Or no.
Yes.
Yeah, something along those lines. Okay, anyway, Robert Gerke, Blake Apgar, both with the Tribune, thanks very much for joining me on the show today.
Happy holidays.
Hey, thank you.
Happy holidays to you. And now on the show, we're going to turn to my conversation that I recorded yesterday with Salt Lake Tribune water and land use reporter Leah Larson, who reported on some new information related to U.S. Magnesium's proposal to dredge to extend their canals in the Great Salt Lake. Here is our conversation. Leah, thanks for being here. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me back.
Of course. Hey, so there is, I think most listeners are going to know this already, but there's this proposal to dredge in the waters of the Great Salt Lake, in the waters and in the lake bed, I guess, of the Great Salt Lake, to extend these canals. Before we get to your latest coverage on this, can you just remind us what this whole proposal is all about and maybe where we are in the process of this proposal, dredging in the Great Salt Lake? Who's behind it?
Yes, so U.S. Magnesium, because the lake has receded so far, they're having a hard time getting the brine they need that they evaporate and extract for minerals. So they want to extend their canals across the lake bed by about 3 miles so they can get to that brine again. And then if the lake continues to recede, they want the option to extend it even farther. And in order to get sign off on that, basically, they need a permit from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, as well as the Utah Division of Water Quality.
Okay. And are they, I mean, I know that there is a permitting process, and this proposal has drawn a lot of opposition from the public. I guess maybe do we have a sense of where we are in how close approval is in coming? And I guess how far along would you say we are in this process, Leah?
How imminent is it? Yeah. So I know that the Division of Water Quality is still reviewing the comments. That's the latest update I got from them. They got a lot of comments, more than 800. I don't even have a final tally because they're still going through them all. So that is still kind of in early stages. U.S. Magnesium, what they told me is they wanted kind of a rushed decision from the Army Corps because things are just so dire for their operation. But when I talked to the Army Corps, they said that that's not a thing. They don't do rush approvals. So, you know, the federal government just kind of moves at its own pace. I think they're also reviewing comments and watching how things go here. So we don't know. This is the short answer. Okay. How's that?
That sounds great. And, you know, there is just to draw attention to another part of this, the sort of state interest in it. I know there's this office called the Public Lands Policy Coordinating Office. It is, I guess, under the governor. Originally, you report that this office was in support of this request from U.S. Magnesium. But not anymore. Can you tell us just basically that part of this story? Why did they go from being in favor to not being in favor?
Right. So that office, it's kind of a mouthful, but I think that, you know, the shortened version, they call it PLPCO. they came out in April urging the Army Corps to approve this permit. Just, you know, U.S. Magnesium is the only source of domestic magnesium right now. Not the only source, but the only producing source of magnesium in the United States. So it you know, they kind of were making the case like this is a national security issue. And then they also brought up the fact that they're producing lithium, and lithium is critical for batteries, car batteries, all kinds of things right now. Although they don't need water to extract lithium, I think it's important to note they are pulling the lithium out of their existing waste piles. So that's kind of like a moot argument. but they really pushed the Army Corps to move quickly on this. But then in the Tribune, we came out with our story detailing all the plans for dredging the canals in September. And 2 days later, the office issued another letter kind of walking back their stance.
Okay. And then so all of the opposition, you brought that up after the Tribune publishes the story. All of these people have public comments and tons of public comments come forward. This week, though, you highlighted some what you might call very well-informed comments of deep concern and, I guess, of opposition to this project by a retired federal scientist by the name of Robert Baskin. Who is Robert Baskin? Maybe we can start with that.
So he worked for the U.S. Geological Survey, and he, I guess his kind of claim to fame is he went through the lake and measured where all these microbialites are in the lake, and some people call it the Great Salt Lake's coral, but they're these rocky structures that are kind of living rocks with these microbial communities that live in them. And they form an important source of the food chain for the brine flies and the brine shrimp. So he has mapped them all and studied them pretty extensively. Great. So that is who he is.
That's who he is. And then I guess his concern about this proposal, I mean, it's, I think that a lot of the public comments that we've seen, or at least that I've been privy to, are more about water use. You know, they're saying if you dredge, you're using more of the water, and the Great Salt Lake has, you know, it's running out of water. His concerns are more about how it's going to kind of affect the water in other ways with, you know, with different consequences. And those microbialites, those structures you described, yeah, play a big role in his concern. Just tell us, sorry, I'm pre-telling the story you're about to tell.
You're teeing me up. Great.
That's great. I'm teeing you up. What is his big concern?
So, so with these microbialites, I think we've reported in the past, like the issue with them is with the lake going down, they're getting exposed to the air, you know, they're surfacing, which is not good. It's killing them. But also with the dredging, Baskin pointed out that because the water's so dense, because it's salty, the sediment floats off a lot farther before it settles. And he's worried it's going to create all the sediment in the lake itself, and it's going to drift and settle on top of these microbialites. And they need photosynthesis. And so if you're covered in a bunch of muck and mud, you're not going to get the sunlight you need. So that will also kill them. And that is a big concern of his that he highlighted that I hadn't considered until I talked to him.
Yeah. I mean, we already know that when these
a mouthful.
I will edit us, but maybe I'll leave some of our messing up in just so people know we're human. But we know that these microbialites, when they are exposed to air, that can also kill them. There is this sort of idea, though, that if you know, they're exposed for a certain period of time, but then the water comes back over them, they can kind of spring back to life. But according to Baskin, that resilience, that spring backableness of the microbialites is also at risk by them being covered with sort of the muck that will come from, potential muck that could come from dredging. Is there an impact on resilience? Is that correct? Am I reading that right in your article?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's just they're getting attacked on multiple fronts, I would say. So, yeah.
Wow. And yeah, you said they're the very, you know, the microorganisms that live in these microbialites, they are the very base of the food chain. They support the pyramid of life out there on the lake. They live in these, I mean, those formations, those coral-like structures as you describe them. Baskin, in your article, says that they build them over thousands of years. And then, you know, the lake is just in such dire straits that I obviously, you know, it's one of those things that you don't worry about until you know about it. Now you know that over thousands of years, these things have been constructed and they're at risk. What does U.S. Magnesium say about this project and the harm it could do?
Well, I asked them if they had a response to like the deluge of comments that have come in opposition, and they didn't really. But I think that, you know, that they would say that they're doing their part to use as little water as they need, just like everybody else. They've told me that, you know, nobody wants to see the lake collapse, including them, but they are trying to stay in business. And I think they would point to the fact, again, that they are the only domestic producer of magnesium. And magnesium is in like all kinds of things that you probably don't even think about, like your soda can, it's in your car parts, it's in the bleachers of the Little League games. So it's, you know, it's a pretty important material. Right. And, you know, President Joe Biden has said that he wants to bring more domestic production of critical materials like that back to the U.S. So I think that is the case that they would argue.
I mean, it is tough when you run into, sorry, this is me waxing and you don't have to comment on this, Leah, but we live in a world where we use certain things. I mean, another concern of Baskin's, for example, has to do with toxic material being dislodged, not just like the sort of turbidness of the water and that's the impact of that getting on the microbialites, but there's another of his concerns has to do with toxic materials that are in the lake bed that could be dislodged by dredging. Can you maybe tell us that part of the story too, Leah?
Yeah, and I think that's a good point that he also brought up. His letter was pretty long, but U.S. Magnesium and their applications say that, you know, this isn't going to impact water quality. If it does, it will be temporary. It's not going to impact the environment. But, you know, U.S. Magnesium is pretty notorious for the amount of pollution it's created, at least in the past. You know, it was being investigated by the EPA for PCBs and dioxins, which are really not good for people, not good for wildlife and birds. He worries about that getting stirred up in the water column. And then, you know, the brine shrimp eat it, the brine flies, you know, get exposed to it, and the birds eat it. And then, you know, it's in the birds and just works its way up the food web because, you know, people do hunt ducks from the Great Salt Lake, so it could even get to people. So, yeah.
Another
we all know about the mercury in the lake. We know about the arsenic in the lake bed. There's just all kinds of stuff out there that maybe we should be careful about stirring up.
Stirring up being the plan here. I mean, you said the word notorious, and I just, Leah, at one point, wasn't U.S. Magnesium considered the largest industrial polluter in the United States? Or maybe it wasn't U.S. Magnesium. Maybe at that time it was Magcor. But I think it was air pollution. You know, we weren't talking about necessarily water or anything like that. It was from smokestacks or something along those lines. Am I right?
Yes, you're right. That's correct. And then, but like the PCB thing and the dioxins was in addition to that. So yes, they did once have that reputation as the largest polluter in the United States. And they've made some reforms to clean that up, but there's still residuals. And I don't know that they've entirely solved the problem.
One other aspect of this that I think is really interesting is stirring up something called selenium, which is an element that we actually need, I think, as humans. We don't eat very much of it. But for birds, the impact is pretty significant in that if you have a certain level of selenium in the food that they eat, that makes it so that their shells, when they're reproducing, when they have eggshells, they can't come together. They can't form. And so, or it weakens the eggshells to an extent that you can't actually have reproduction.
Yes, exactly. And Brian Maffley's done a lot more reporting on that, but I believe the selenium is coming from Kennecott that mine, not U.S. Magnesium, but it's still in the same area in the same sediment that would be stirred up. So yes, that's another material concern.
Man, the lake is just facing so many problems. How about, is there any good news? I mean, we've had some pretty sizable winter weather storms. Are we going to see more water getting to the lake? I know you kind of tackled this in an earlier article. Yeah, is there some good news on the horizon here, Leah?
You know, it's just, it's too soon to say. That winter storm that we were kind of all hopeful for this week kind of fizzled.
Yeah.
I was looking at the snowpack numbers from the snow survey, and the percentages have actually gone down since I wrote this story, which is kind of sad, but they're still above average, which is good. But it's, you know, like, it's not going to recover in a year, bottom line. Like, it's just, I don't think we would ever get that kind of snow. If we're lucky, maybe 2 years, if it was just like a bomber 2 years.
We can always hope. Or,
well, I think we need to maybe come to terms with the fact that we're just becoming drier, you know, and maybe the snow that we are used to isn't coming, so we have to find other solutions.
Yeah, and I remember being a kid and just seeing what, or, you know, maybe I was smaller, but the snow here seemed a lot bigger way back when.
I agree with you.
Yeah. Are we just nostalgic? Are we just misremembering? Or, you know, I guess there's data that shows that we obviously are getting drier.
The whole region, is getting drier.
Leah Larson, water and land use reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune. I really appreciate your telling us about these proposals, and thanks for covering so much on the beat that you cover. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, happy to do it. Thanks.
Again, that's Leah Larson. You can find her coverage and all of the stories that we've been discussing today at sltrib.com. I hope you recognize the value of local journalism and contribute to support both KCPW and the Tribune, two nonprofit news outlets. Otherwise, thank you for listening. I'm Roger McDonough. Again, you've been tuned to Behind the Headlines, a co-production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. Have a lovely holiday. Join us again soon.